facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.
The Weeknd is here. Thank you, Daniel Craig. At some point this weekend, maybe I'll get out to see No Time to Die. Man, I've been putting that off. Gotta see it. Just haven't had the time. 1-888-914-9149 is a toll-free line to call. I've been preparing great radio for you on The Cale Clark Show. And you can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. Or you can tweet at me, follow me on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. The show account is at Cale Clark Show. So once again, that phone number to call, 1-888-914-9149. Saw a really cool article about Jordan Peterson and his take on C.S. Lewis. Now, most of you know who Jordan Peterson is. He's a worldwide phenomenon. He lives right here in my city of Toronto, and he's a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He has been since 1998. Before that, he was at Harvard. And he is the author of the runaway best-selling books, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, and also the follow-up book, which just came out this year, called Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life. He's probably the most famous public intellectual in the world today. He's just a massive success story on YouTube. He's got well over 4 million followers on his YouTube channel. Some of his videos have been viewed multiple millions of times. And if you've read his book, 12 Rules for Life, you know that he has a very interesting take on God and the Bible. And I think he's really, really spiritually searching. And I would love to talk to this guy. Maybe one day I'll get to meet him. But Christopher Cazor, Dr. Christopher Cazor, who's a professor of philosophy at Loyola Marymount University in California, he's written a piece for the Catholic World Report called Jordan Peterson, C.S. Lewis, and the wishful thinking objection to God. And maybe you've come across this in your own life with skeptics, people that you're dealing with, that this whole concept of God is nothing more than wishful thinking. And so really what Dr. Christopher Cazor says, and he, by the way, he's written a book about, it's called Jordan Peterson, God and Christianity. And I'm going to have actually much, much more to say about this book in future episodes of The Cale Clark Show. So please keep it glued here. Same bat time, same bat channel in the future. And in the very, very near future, I'm going to have a lot more stuff on this, and I can't wait to get into it. But Dr. Christopher Cazor, he says, look, regardless of what an atheist might wish for, or even a theist, somebody who believes in God, or an agnostic person, somebody who's not sure, either the God of the Bible really does exist, or he doesn't. It's pretty binary at the end of it all. Here's what Jordan Peterson writes in 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. Here's a quote from Jordan Peterson. He says, quote, I had outgrown the shallow Christianity of my youth by the time I could understand the fundamentals of Darwinian theory. After that, I could not distinguish the basic elements of Christian belief from wishful thinking. End of quote. Okay, I want to talk about the wishful thinking part in just a second, but as most of you probably know, if somebody does hold to evolution, and whether you do or you don't, and some people sort of have a moderate view, they believe in evolution to some extent, maybe microevolution like within a species, like a giraffe growing a longer neck, for example, or something like that, but they don't necessarily believe in macroevolution, you know, the idea that one thing can become another, you know, a tadpole can become a frog, can become a chimp, can become a human, that sort of thing. I don't believe in those quantum leaps, you might say, but regardless of your take on this, some evolutionary theories, some evolutionary theories could be compatible with the Catholic faith. You know, if you did hold to evolution, you'd have to hold it at some point that God infused an immortal soul into the first human person, regardless of where you think the body came from. And some people say that, well, maybe God used an evolutionary process to bring about the human body. God formed man out of the dust of the earth. Well, that could refer to an eons-long process. Okay, well, as long as you hold that God had to, at some point, infuse an immortal soul into that first human, then that could be compatible with our faith. But I don't really want to get too deep down that rabbit hole, but only to say that Jordan Peterson, when he started reading Darwin's theories, he started to sort of doubt what he called his shallow Christianity that he had in his early formative years. And Dr. Christopher Cazor notes that he's interacted a lot with the thought of C.S. Lewis, as Jordan Peterson. And in a recent clip, I'm going to play this for you in just a second, from Jordan Peterson's YouTube channel, where he's interacting with another YouTuber named Jonathan Pageau, he talks a little bit about his take on C.S. Lewis. So, and this is actually really, really powerful audio. So you're going to want to check this out. Have a listen.
Okay, so you can think about Christ from a psychological perspective, and this particular critic that I've been reading said, well, that doesn't differentiate Christ much from a whole sequence of dying and resurrecting mythological gods. And of course, people have made that claim in comparative religion. Joseph Campbell did that, and Jung to a lesser degree, I would say, but Campbell did that. But the difference, and C.S. Lewis pointed this out as well, the difference between those mythological gods and Christ was that there's a representation of, there's a historical representation of his existence as well. Now, you can debate whether or not that's genuine. You can debate about whether or not he actually lived and whether there's credible objective evidence for that, but it doesn't matter in some sense because this, well, it does, but there's a sense in which it doesn't matter because there's still a historical story. And so what you have in the figure of Christ is an actual person who actually lived plus a myth. And in some sense, Christ is the union of those two things. The problem is I probably believe that, but I don't know. Okay. I'm amazed at my own belief and I don't understand it. Like, because I've seen, sometimes the objective world and the narrative world touch. You know, that's Jungian synchronicity. Yeah. And I've seen that many times in my own life. And so in some sense, I believe it's undeniable. You know, we have a narrative sense of the world. For me, that's been the world of morality. That's the world that tells us how to act. It's real. Like, we treat it like it's real. It's not the objective world. But the narrative and the objective world touch. And the ultimate example of that, in principle, is supposed to be Christ. But I don't know what to, that seems to me oddly plausible.
Yeah.
Well, but I still don't know what to make of it. It's too, partly because it's too terrifying a reality to fully believe. I don't even know what would happen to you if you fully believed it.
Now, you probably caught that on the audio, but Jordan Peterson was actually breaking down in that video. He was getting very, very emotional about this. And if you watch the video clip, and we can provide a link to it in the show notes, it's a really powerful moment. Like, this guy is really searching. He is really searching. Pray for Jordan Peterson, because he is looking for God. He's looking for truth here. And at first I thought, when I listened to that, that he was sort of questioning whether or not Christ was a historical person. But I think as you listen more to that clip, I think he's saying, no, he is a historical reality. And there's no, by the way, there's no accredited historian on the planet who has a PhD teaching history today who would deny that Christ exists. There's no one that I would know who has an actual teaching position who would deny that. It's very, very few people would. There's just such overwhelming evidence for the existence of Christ as a historical figure that it's overwhelming. And he's trying to figure out who Christ is. And we'll have much more to say, like I said, in future episodes about the faith of Jordan Peterson, where he's going. Dr. Cazor has written a really interesting book about this. But wow, just the raw emotion really came across here. But I want to focus a little bit about what he said about C.S. Lewis in this audio interview that he did with Jonathan Pageau. Jordan Peterson said, quote, "There seems to be something too convenient about C.S. Lewis. His insistence that the perfection of Christ also had to manifest itself concretely in reality at one point in history," end of quote. Well, what Dr. Chris Cazor in his article says, okay, let's examine this wishful thinking. Quote, "Is Christian belief a case of wishful thinking? Is it too good to be true? Is it a convenient creed that should be rejected because it is too convenient? It seems too good to be true. Well, Jordan Peterson has from time to time interacted with the thought of C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis said this about this wishful thinking angle. Here's what he said, quote, "I didn't go to religion to make me happy." This is C.S. Lewis speaking. "I didn't go to religion to make me happy. I always knew a bottle of port could do that." "If you want a religion to make you feel really comfortable, I certainly don't recommend Christianity." End of quote. And when he said that, I mean, it sounds an awful lot like what a fellow convert to Christianity, really a convert to the Catholic faith, G.K. Chesterton once said, "It's not that Christianity has been tried and been found wanting. It has been found difficult and has been left untried." How true that is. It hasn't been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried. There is a difficulty to it. We do have to pick up our cross, take up our cross daily, as Jesus said. But here's another thing that Jesus said in John's gospel. "If anyone wants to know whether my teaching," and I'm paraphrasing here, but he says, "If anyone wants to know whether my teaching comes from God, let him do the teaching," or "let her do the teaching." In other words, put it into practice and you will know experientially whether this comes from God or not. So C.S. Lewis said, "I did not go to Christianity to make me happy," to sort of wishful thinking. Oh, wouldn't it be nice if all these things were true? That there's a benevolent, loving God in heaven. "I didn't go to look for happiness." He said, "I always knew a good bottle of port could do that." He said, "Look, I reject this watered down take on Christianity." Quote, this is Lewis talking again, "the view which simply says there is a good God in heaven and everything is all right, leaving out all the difficult and terrible doctrines about sin and hell and the devil and the redemption." So C.S. Lewis did accept all of these teachings of Christ because Jesus really did say these things. Let's look at just one example. In John chapter 5, verses 25 through 29, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the hour is coming and now is when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself and has given him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come forth. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment." So this is the teaching of Jesus on the double resurrection. It's one of the places where he talks about this. The resurrection of the good, the bad, and the ugly, the just and the unjust. And so Jesus talked about this in a lot of different places. Matthew 25, in Mark chapter 9, Luke 16, that very famous parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and how, you know, once you die, your eternity is fixed. You either die in God's friendship or you don't. So this is not exactly super consoling for everybody because of the fact that Christ demands a change of life if you're going to take him seriously. And Chris Cazor says, hey, look, if C.S. Lewis was looking for merely the kind of creed that would make you happy, he wasn't looking for that. He was looking for truth. And he mentions another theologian who he coined this really interesting phrase, Richard Niebuhr, about the kind of watered down Christianity that a lot of people are really looking for. A lot of people are looking for, quote, a God without wrath who brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. I'm going to say that again. It's such a good quote. A God without wrath brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. End of quote. That was from H. Richard Niebuhr. So this is basically Christ without a cross, it's cheap Christianity, and it's wishful thinking. That really is wishful thinking. That's not what Jesus taught. So Jordan Peterson he looks at the fact that there are consoling doctrines in Christianity. They are comforting. It is consoling to believe that God's mercy can forgive any sin. That's a great comfort. But just because that's comforting, that doesn't mean that it's wishful thinking. It doesn't mean that. The real question is it true? Is it true? And C.S. Lewis gives another analogy, and it may be somewhat obscure, but it's an analogy from the world of accounting. The world of accounting. And here's what C.S. Lewis said. Quote, suppose I think after doing my accounts that I have a large balance at the bank. Got a lot of money in the bank. Suppose you want to find out whether I really do or not, whether or not this belief of mine that I have a lot of money in the bank is simply wishful thinking. Now, you can never come to any conclusion by examining my psychological condition. Your only chance of finding out is to sit down and work through it all yourself. When you have checked my figures, then and only then will you know whether or not I have that bank balance. If you find my arithmetic correct, then no amount of vaporing about my psychological condition can be anything but a waste of time. So in other words, if somebody thinks I've got a lot of money in the bank, the thing to do is not say, well, why does he think that? He's very comforted by this fact that he's got a lot of money in the bank. But the easiest way to figure out whether this guy has any reason to be comforted or to think this way is to do an audit. Check out his bank balance. Check the paperwork. Check the figures. Check the ledger. Does he really have this money? Borrow his bank card. Get his PIN code and figure it out if he'll give it to you. And C.S. Lewis says, if you find my arithmetic wrong, then it may be relevant to explain psychologically how I came to be so bad at math and how the doctrine of the concealed wish will become relevant, but only after you have done the accounting and discovered me to be purely wrong on purely arithmetical grounds. It's the same with all thinking and all systems of thought, end of quote. So what's he saying there? The psychological benefits that you get from the faith, don't look at people's psychological state. Look at the facts of the case. Look at whether or not this religion is true. And if it is true, then you have good reason to feel confident in it. You have good reason to feel good about the future because God is in control. And Chris Kazor says that you can find people who are into wishful thinking who are on all sides of the question of religion. And he talks about an atheist named Thomas Nagel, who wrote this. He said, quote, and this is a really, really honest take by this atheist, Thomas Nagel. He said, quote, I want atheism to be true. That's really refreshing. He said, I want atheism to be true, and I am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God, and naturally I hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. End of quote. Wow, that is, like I said, that is a really refreshingly honest take. He said, I want atheism to be true. And it really bugs me that a lot of smart people I know are religious believers because I don't want there to be a God because I don't want the universe to actually be like that. And to be honest with you, that's the reason why a lot of people don't want to convert. Although I do admit that there are some people who are honest seekers, and maybe Jordan Peterson's in that category, who are really need to look at the historical evidence for this faith, that it is real, that these acts did take place in human history. It's not a myth in the sense of a nice fairy tale that never happened. There are people who do view Christianity, who do view Catholicism as some sort of medieval superstition that's been disproved by modern science. You know, people will say to you, you don't seriously believe that stuff, do you? There are a lot of folks like that out there. But Thomas Nagel, the atheist, I think his view encapsulates the reason why a lot of people don't become Christian or don't become Catholic. They don't want it to be true, because they know that they're going to have to change their life. They don't like the consequences of it being true from a moral point of view, maybe. So we've got to use reason here. We've got to look at the evidence. So back to C.S. Lewis here. Dr. Chris Kazor quotes him saying something else, and this is also quite interesting. A lot of people think of God in a very impersonal sense. It's almost like the Star Wars God, the Force, an impersonal life force. Well, C.S. Lewis said this, quote, "The life force is a sort of tame God. You can switch it on when you want, but it will not bother you. All the thrills of religion and none of the cost. Is the life force the greatest achievement of wishful thinking the world has yet seen?" End of quote. But then he says, when you go into some rooms and you start talking about God, the temperature drops as soon as you mention a God who has purpose, who performs particular actions, who does one thing and not another, a concrete, choosing, commanding, prohibiting God with a determinate character. So a lot of people want this impersonal God, this sort of life force that they think they can tap into whenever they need it, but a God who has actual commandments, who separates good from evil, who has a cross that he wants you to pick up and carry. A lot of people don't like that kind of talk. And so a lot of people wish that to be true, but is that in fact the case? Is that in fact the case? The God of the Bible either really does exist or he doesn't, if he doesn't. And one more quote from C.S. Lewis as we go to break. He says, "If Christianity is untrue, then no honest man will want to believe it, however helpful it might be. But if it is true, every honest man will want to believe it, even if it gives him no help at all." We'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the program, 1-888-914-9149. If you want to call in and have a question, I will post a link to the article by Dr. Chris Kazor on Jordan Peterson versus C.S. Lewis, if you will, if that's how you want to phrase it, on this question of wishful thinking and God. And one of the things I said as we were discussing that in the last segment was, you've really got to look at the evidence for the position. And if it is true, it's either true or it's not. And if it is true, guess what? It has all these benefits that it brings to your life. You can really trust in them, that they're grounded in reality. And one of the ways that we can buttress our knowledge of the truth, if you will, and confirm the fact that God did really act in history, throughout salvation history, through his people Israel, and also in the New Covenant time, through Jesus of Nazareth. This is where archaeology is really our friend. And Eric Metaxas in Newsweek magazine put out an interesting piece called "Is Archaeology Proving the Bible?" I'm going to get to that in just a second. It was pretty fascinating. First of all, let me just answer the question: what is archaeology? What exactly is archaeology? I think we all kind of know what it is. We've seen Indiana Jones, and we think we know what it is. And trust me, I've done a little bit of archaeological work in the Holy Land, and it's not nearly as glamorous as the movies. It's just a lot of sweating and digging in the hot sun. It's not glamorous at all. But here's the actual definition of archaeology. It's the study of uncovering ancient artifacts and material culture. So this could include any number of things. It could include buildings that have been uncovered, their ruins, their foundations, documents. In the case of the New Testament, we're looking at scrolls, papyrus scrolls, manuscripts of the New Testament. Could be anything. Coins. When I was working on digs outside of Jerusalem, that was one of the things we used to find a lot. And it's really like a layer cake as you're digging through the different layers. The further down you go in the ground, the farther back you go in time, because one civilization builds upon another. So if you find a coin, that's actually pretty good, because coins usually are dated, just like, you know, the change in your pocket. Everybody's paying digitally now, of course, and using their credit cards. So there's less and less coins in circulation, but you know what I'm talking about. And if you find a coin, it's usually got a date. It's usually got the figurehead of a ruler or whatever on it. So you can kind of say, okay, we're in this time period now. So these are really, really important things to find. And it can really shed light on the Bible. And what it does is, and even when we find archaeological evidence, people do argue about what it really means, but what we're really trying to do is understand the culture of the time. And a lot of archaeologists, Eric Klein, who's an archaeologist and he teaches at George Washington University, he says, quote, "Most biblical archaeologists do not deliberately set out to either prove or disprove elements of the Hebrew Bible," and that's another fancy way of saying the Old Testament, maybe a more accurate way of saying the Old Testament. It's often called the Hebrew Bible, because when you say old, you know, nobody wants to read the old news. We want to go to the new stuff, but it's still valid. God speaks to us through it today. It's still the Word of God. So they don't set out, archaeologists, to try to prove or disprove the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, but what they do is look at the finds, look at the material culture of the lands, the time periods mentioned in the Bible, people, places, events discussed in those texts to kind of try to bring them to life and to reconstruct the culture and the history of the region. But very often, finds are made that are very, very specific to certain biblical accounts, certain biblical texts. And there have been actually, Greg Manette says he calls them the great eight discoveries that have been made relating to Jesus and his world. And some of them were actually discussed in this article by Eric Metaxas. And writing in Newsweek, he says, in 1846, before the field of archaeology ever really existed as a field, there was an Assyrian obelisk that was discovered in northern Iraq, what is now northern Iraq. And it talked about Jehu, a 9th century BC king. A Hebrew king that's mentioned in the Bible. And that was the first time that archaeology really dug up something that was mentioned specifically in the Bible. And people were super excited about this discovery. And then as archaeology continued to grow and develop, more and more finds started to turn up. And so a lot of the criticisms about the Bible that it's a made-up collection of folk tales, a lot of those fell by the wayside once real hard evidence of people, places, things, events that are mentioned in the Old and New Testaments came to light. For example, Luke, and his feast day is coming up on Monday, St. Luke, and we're going to talk about some of his writings on the Faith Explained series. We've got a brand new series, by the way, starting on Monday for the Faith Explained, 12:30 Central. It's called The Biblical Roots of the Rosary. I think you're really going to dig this. And we're going to dig into some of the biblical accounts of the mysteries of the Rosary, including St. Luke's take on the Annunciation in Luke chapter 1, the first joyful mystery. And Luke says at the beginning of his gospel and also the Acts of the Apostles, and Luke is really the author of a two-volume set, really it's about a quarter of the New Testament, Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles put together, and he dedicates them to the same person, this person named Theophilus, and we don't know whether he was an actual guy or not. There's a lot of dispute about this. But here's what it says in Luke chapter 1. I'm just going to read this to you because it's really cool. Luke says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word." So he's basically saying a lot of people wrote about Jesus. A lot of people have wanted to write life stories of him. You may be referring to the other gospel writers as well. He said, look, there are people who are eyewitnesses of his life, and they've delivered things, they passed things on. He said, "It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus." Now, the word Theophilus, by the way, means lover of God, so it could be just a generic to the reader, you know, you all love God, hopefully you'll get something out of this. Or it could be an actual person. There's some actual persons in ancient, at the time, named Theophilus, and people speculate about who that might be. Some people think it was actually the high priest at a certain time in history. That's another story for another day. But he writes to this Theophilus so that he might know, Luke says, the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed. So he wants to write this account to show, yeah, these things really happened, Theophilus, when it comes to the life of Christ. So Now, Luke was not one of the 12 apostles. He didn't hang out with Jesus on earth, but he was, of course, a traveling companion of the apostle Paul. And so he would have learned a lot about the apostles from Paul. And Paul didn't know Jesus personally during his life and ministry either. He encountered Jesus after Jesus ascended into heaven, the whole Damascus Road experience, all that stuff. But Luke has in every way proved to be a very careful historian. He's investigated, he's interviewed. He probably, in all likelihood, interviewed Mary. That's how he gets all this info about the Annunciation and the visitation. That's not in the other Gospels. All these little details, he probably talked to Our Lady when he was compiling his Gospel. And so Luke has really come up gold. You know, he's come up aces when it comes to people, places, events that he mentions in his Gospel. All of these things, a lot of these things have been sort of backed up by what we've discovered through archaeology. So way back in 1959 even, and that's even before some of the more recent discoveries, there was a rabbi named Dr. Nelson Glueck, and he said, no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. So there's never been anything uncovered in archaeology that has disproved anything in the scriptures. And Eric Metaxas mentions the famous Pontius Pilate inscription that was unearthed in 1961. By the way, that's one of the great eight discoveries relating to Jesus. If you want to know what the rest of them are, I can tell you. I'll just tell you real quick what they are. It's the Pontius Pilate inscription. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. The bone box belonging to Caiaphas, the high priest, who condemned Jesus to death. His ossuary, that's the box his bones were buried in. Also, the bones of his granddaughter were discovered, Caiaphas' granddaughter. The ossuary of James, who was... It says James, the brother of Jesus. What does that mean, brother? Oh, we can get into that another time. The remnants of a first century, almost really the entire boat was discovered, a first century fishing boat. And if you've been to Israel, you've been to the Holy Land, you might have gone to a place called Gennesaret on the shores of Lake Galilee, and you can see the boat. A boat from the first century, somewhat like Jesus and the apostles might have used when they were out fishing. Some people like to say, it's the boat. This is actually Peter's boat. We don't know if it actually belonged to Peter, but it was like that boat. It's from that same time period. An incredible find. The synagogue where Jesus preached in Capernaum. And you might want to also add in, Peter's house has been found in Capernaum. The sixth discovery was the remains of a crucified man named Yehohanan, which sheds light on Jesus' crucifixion. The village of Nazareth itself, and what they found there, and also the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's number eight. So those are the great eight archaeological discoveries relating to the New Testament. So this Pontius Pilate inscription, I've seen this with my own eyes. And this was found in 1961, and it was found in Caesarea Philippi. And this is a great... Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea by the sea. And Herod the Great set up this incredible... city called Caesarea Maritima. It had like a hippodrome, which was a really cool kind of racetrack thing where all kinds of things took place, sporting events. Also a great theater. And this, some archaeologists in 1961 were walking up the steps of this theater, and one of them stepped on a rock, and it kind of slipped under his foot, and whoa, it kind of moved. And so he said, I wonder if there's something on the other side of this. I don't know what made him think this, but he just flipped over the step, the stone slab that had kind of moved under his foot. And sure enough, there was an inscription on the other side. And I guess at some point in the theater's life, they had simply found this stone and repurposed it as a step in the theater. And this is incredible. And it actually said something about Pontius Pilate. It had the name Pontius Pilate on it. Now, this is amazing because up until this time, a lot of people doubted whether Pontius Pilate was a real historical figure, or maybe the New Testament writers were making him up. Maybe there was no such guy. Well, here you have it in stone. Pontius Pilate is mentioned. And really, this was the remnants of an ancient inscription. There was some sort of dedication to Pontius Pilate. And it said, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. The people, it's in limestone. And by the way, it gave us his rank. A lot of people didn't know what Pilate's rank was before that time. Well, now we know that he was in fact a prefect. So there it is. So there it is, Pilot in stone. And if you go to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, you'll see this Pontius Pilate stone on display in the Jesus of Nazareth section, right alongside the bone box of Caiaphas the high priest and the evidence of a crucified man. It's all right together, and it all relates to the death of Jesus. In 1968, a first century home in Capernaum was identified as, you guessed it, the House of Peter. And if you go there today in Capernaum, it's a great place to visit. But they built this sort of modern church in the 1970s over top of Peter's ancient home. And it looks like a spaceship. It really doesn't fit at all. If you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. And that's pretty amazing, too. There's all this graffiti in the home from this first century saying basically, you know, Peter used to live here, that sort of stuff. And in all likelihood, the early Christians celebrated Mass at the home of Peter in Capernaum. In 1990, the ossuary of Caiaphas was discovered. And then in 1993, there was a stele, there was a stone slab that was discovered at a place called Tel Dan. And I mentioned this on the Faith Explained show the other day. This was way up near the Syrian border, the modern-day border between Israel and Syria. People used to doubt whether or not David was a historical person. They think David never existed. He never had this big kingdom. There was never this line of kings like Solomon and everybody that came after him. He was all just made up. He didn't exist. Well, that was put to rest when this stone slab was found, and it mentions the house of David. This Assyrian king is bragging about defeating the armies of the house of David. This probably comes from the 9th century BC, right around the time of David, Solomon, and all their successors. This guy's like, hey, I beat the armies of the house of David. And everybody should know this, so I'm going to put it up on display here. This is kind of stuff that people should know, these public inscriptions. Now, if David didn't exist, why would he say such a thing? And the biblical minimalists who wanted to say that, well, they were kind of handed their lunch, and so they started saying things like, okay, all right, maybe David existed, but he was a nobody. He was just a local tribal chief. Well, that was kind of put to bed. Well, first of all, why are his successors fighting these huge battles way from Jerusalem, his home base, if he had this small little kingdom? He was just a local tribal chief. And they found this incredible government complex in the old city of Jerusalem with all these buildings and headquarters. And this is a sprawling organization. So David was not a nobody. He was a historical person, and what the Old Testament says about him, the Hebrew Bible, is very, very plausible indeed. But just 2 weeks ago, an incredible find relating to the Old Testament was published in a paper in what was called Nature Scientific Reports. It's a peer-reviewed publication, and it talks about the ancient destruction of the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah. We may have some archaeological evidence for this, and I'm going to tell you what that is right after this break. Got to take a quick break right now on the Cale Clark Show, 1-888-914-9149. Be right back.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back. It's our final segment of the show, final segment of the week. Man, it's gone by quick on The Cale Clark Show. Well, just before the break, just a little teaser. Eric Metaxas, writing in Newsweek, talked about the possible discovery of the biblical sites of Sodom and Gomorrah. And this was published just a few weeks ago in Nature Scientific Reports. And the guy who was sort of in charge of the site, Dr. Stephen Collins, the archaeologist who kind of excavated this place, he actually used the Bible to try to find the site. And this is very, very common in archaeology, that they will use the Bible as their guide to find different places where they're hoping to dig up the material evidence of these sites. And he knew, Stephen Collins knew, that if this place ever existed, that this particular site, and today it's called Tel El Hammam, that's got to be the place. It's got to be the place. So he started excavating it in the year 2006. And as remember how I told you before that it's kind of like a layer cake. The further down you dig in the ground, you're going back civilization upon civilization, time period upon time period. The further down you go, the farther back in time you go. Well, when they got down to about the time period of 1650 BC, that's around the time when they believed that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. What they found was a 5-foot layer of soot. And scattered throughout this, what they called destruction matrix, they found bits of melted brick, fragments of human bones, and all kinds of stuff that was kind of hard to explain because there was no volcanic eruption or earthquake or any other natural event like a fire that could have produced something like this. And so when they came upon all this stuff, Dr. Stephen Collins found the shard of a jar. And he said, okay, and he kind of knew from his training, this is about from 1700 BC. This is pretty old. But it was really weird because one side of this jar had this glaze, this glassy green glaze. Now, to be able to have that kind of color, the glaze on a glass jar, there was no technology to make that for another 24 centuries. So he's like, well, how did this come to be? And so he took it to a lab in New Mexico, and they figured out that this pottery was melted by super intense heat that lasted for a really, really short period of time. Super intense, really quick. Now, what on earth could cause that? Well, here's another fact about the site. Now, for millennia before this happened, there were huge settlements there. People lived there. It was inhabited. There was farming. There was all kinds of stuff growing there. But after this, whatever happened in 1700 BC, for over 700 years, no humans lived there after this event. It's kind of raised a big question in the researchers' minds. Unmatched natural resources were here before. All kinds of, in terms of the site where it was located, great military advantages. It's a good place to build a city. How come nobody lived there for so long after this? Well, they kept looking into it. Well, what Dr. Stephen Collins came to think, and what this article in the Nature magazine says in detail, is that they think what happened at the site was what they called a cosmic airburst or an impact event. And it said it's very, very similar to something that happened in Siberia in the year 1908. And in 1908, there was an asteroid that was about 180 feet in diameter. That's huge. It entered the Earth's atmosphere, traveling at 34,000 miles per hour, and then it exploded. And when it exploded, it exploded above a region that was pretty much nobody lived there, thankfully. But it was an incredible impact. Apparently, it was the equivalent of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs. Think about how devastating that explosion was at the end of World War II. The equivalent of a blast of 1,000 atomic bombs. This flattened 80 million trees. This 1908 asteroid blast, 80 million trees were destroyed, and it really messed up the atmosphere. For 3 days, people in London, Eric Metaxas says, could read newspapers at midnight. It really messed things up. So apparently this event that happened at the biblical sites of Sodom and Gomorrah was even more powerful than that. So just to put it into some context for you, the most powerful, the worst hurricanes that we see today will have winds at about 200 miles an hour. This explosion generated winds of 700 miles per hour. Walls that were 15 feet thick were utterly obliterated. The heat was so hot that thousands of inhabitants who lived there were instantly vaporized. In fact, the temperature at the center of the explosion would have been 18,000 degrees Fahrenheit or more. That's how hot the explosion in Siberia was in 1908. That was 18,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This one might have been even worse. The charred bone fragments that they've dug up, along with the pottery, plaster, bits and pieces of roofs of buildings, they told the researchers that for 25 seconds, the temperature would have been 3,500 degrees. That's hot enough to melt titanium. So this is amazing. And in fact, the only thing that's even comparable to what they found there are the atomic bomb tests that took place in New Mexico in 1945. And when they did that, the sands in New Mexico would melt into this glaze that was this glass glaze that was very similar to what the archaeologist Stephen Collins found in the pottery. And so when he first showed it to a scientist, this person said, oh, that's obviously from New Mexico, 1945, the atomic bomb test, right? No, it's actually from 1700 BC. What? What could cause an explosion like that? So this seems very, very, it seems to dovetail with what the Bible says about the destruction of the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah. And stones falling from the sky, could be an asteroid, fire coming down from the sky, thick smoke, devastation of a city, tons of deaths, crops destroyed, nobody lives there, it just becomes barren. And so this could be a case, yet another case of archaeology backing up what the scriptures say. We're going to go to the phones right now. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Cale. I just wanted to ask about your guest yesterday that you had on the Anglican
Andrew
Ordinarian.
Pettibrand, yeah.
And I wondered, what would be the difference in an Anglican Ordinariate Mass versus a regular Roman Catholic Mass?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Paul. And for those of you who missed the show yesterday, you can check out the podcast. Andrew Pettibrand, who is a former Anglican cleric who's now Catholic, he's written a lot of great stuff and works for Word on Fire now. He's the fellow of popular culture there. Really fun conversation we had with him about his conversion and a lot of other stuff yesterday. So the church has created what's called an Anglican Ordinariate for Anglicans who want to become Catholic. And in some cases, entire parishes have come into the Catholic Church. And the church has kind of allowed them to have their own liturgy, which is very similar to what they had in the Anglican Communion, but it's Catholic. But it's Catholic with a valid Eucharist and all that stuff. And so I've never been to an Anglican service, so I can't really say how different it might be from a Novus Ordo Mass, but the church does allow for different liturgical expressions. Obviously, when you think about the Orthodox churches of the East and their divine liturgy, and I know you're Orthodox, Paul, when you go to an Eastern Catholic liturgy, you'd find a lot of similarities. If you went to a Coptic Catholic Mass or an Ethiopian Catholic Mass or a Melkite Catholic Mass, you would find a lot of similarities to an Eastern Orthodox liturgy. And a lot of people who attend the Novus Ordo, they'd say, well, this doesn't seem familiar to me, but it's still the Mass. It's a different expression of it with the divine liturgy, but there you have it. And so the church has made this, has created this as a way to make it easier for people to be reunited with the one church founded by Jesus Christ, the Catholic Church. And so that is a really good question. But yeah, so unfortunately, I have no personal experience of that, so I can't comment on that too much.
One way I spot Episcopal churches is they all seem to have red doors on the exterior. And I didn't know if that was the case in the Ordinariate.
I didn't know that. Well, so thanks for that, Paul. I really appreciate that. And thanks for that question. Yeah, so if you missed that conversation yesterday, anybody check that out on the podcast. And producer Lucas is back now. He was away on vacation. He's
I missed
back,
you,
and
Cale.
So I missed you too, man. Missed you too. Patrick and I had a lot of fun, and he did a great job filling in for you. But it's good to have you back. But unfortunately, you didn't get back in time to create the week that was. So people are once again just going to have to listen to all the shows.
I'm sorry.
Weekend and binge.
You can send all the hate mail to Cale at relevantradio.com.
But we'll make up for it next week. Trust me. And
yeah.
So that's amazing to have you back. And where did you go on your trip?
Well, I'll tell you what. I actually went on a retreat for the first time ever. The Conventual Franciscans have a retreat house here. It's the National Shrine of St. Maximilian Kolbe in Illinois. And it was amazing. If you've never been on a retreat, take the time to do it and reconnect to God, because we all need the rest. That's for sure.
Well, I hope you guys get some rest this weekend. Have a wonderful weekend, and congratulations on your first retreat, Lucas, the first of many. Hope you said a prayer for me, and I hope you listeners do as well. I'll pray for you. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.